why we believe all these strange things with black holes are happening. And so after I first talk about these three-chiral geometries a little bit, I'll tell you what few things we've been able to do and what other things one might want to do with it in the future. But after that, I want to go to more abstract things, which are very much just ideas in progress, and it should give you a good starting point to think more about it if you should choose to do so. And so one question I would like to ask is, what is space-time? Often you must have heard that space-time is, people try to make models where space-time is made of discrete bits. Sometimes people think there's a cutoff at Planck length, so if you have some volume, you divide into little cells of size Planck length cube volume each. Well, that looks a little bit too crude. As we know, it doesn't have to be like that. But the whole idea of making space-time discrete because of quantum gravity, because gravity is really quantized, some kind of discreteness in space-time people have struggled with for a long time, and perhaps you've thought of similar things in various contexts. But we'll see when we start from the idea of ADS-CFT duality, the CFT is rather discrete. You'll see rather discrete things in the CFT. The space-time looks rather continuous, just like a manifold. But we'll see that there are actually, by looking at the dual CFT, there are hints of how you might want to understand what space-time is, where is this kind of hidden discreteness, where it might be hiding in space-time. So play a little bit with these ideas. Then I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this whole idea of why these states in string theory, which are like black hole states, are becoming so big. So you recall that our basic postulate was, if a state has a high amount of entropy, that means if there's a large degeneracy of states for the same mass and charge, then the state can't be very small. It will be a fairly big object. In fact, big enough that if you try to measure the surface area of this ball, it will satisfy a Bekenstein kind of relation. The area upon 4G would give you the number of states in that volume. And we'd like to see how we come to those kinds of ideas. So all these calculations will be very rough. We're just trying to get some impressions of how to think in this in these directions so that we can have some faith that these concrete calculations, which very slowly give us one metric here or one metric there, why are we trying to pursue such a program? And so what I would like to do in particular, I didn't put too much on the slides today, but I just want to see if we can, when we start talking about such things, if you want to have a discussion or questions about it, we'll just pause and take those questions instead, because anyway, the whole thing is somewhat abstract and philosophical, and questions are better than my just talking out here on the screen. Okay, so first let me start about talking about three-chiral geometries. And again here, before we actually start making any three-chiral geometries, I just want to give you a little abstract thought on it. So what's the issue here? We made the three-charge metric in the first of these lectures, and you remember how the metric looked. Again, flat space at infinity, then there was this kind of a throat. At r equal to zero, there was a horizon. We measured the area of that horizon, and we computed A upon 4G and got the entropy. You recall we did all that for the three-charge black hole, and that's the horizon, and it's a completely smooth horizon. It's just like the horizon of an ordinary Reichstein-Nordström black hole, which you might read about in any GR book. And then if you take that horizon, if you just continue this thing in your Kruskal diagram, then inside you will find a singularity, the same singularities you always find inside all horizons, inside all black holes. This is a completely classical black hole. So in fact, if for this completely classical black hole, we could have the kind of ideas or macrostate construction which we did with the two-charge system in full detail in the last lecture, then in fact, we would actually learn something rather deep. We would learn that these big classical black holes, which can be miles in diameter, all over those scales of several miles, we had to think about physics all differently. And that looks very surprising. At the horizon, all the metric looks completely smooth. All the curvature scales are millions of kilometers. Nothing bad is happening in this whole region. How would this whole picture change because of quantum gravity? That is the task we have to understand. And let's just start talking about it from some simple abstract arguments, then make a few microstates, and then some more abstract arguments, and try to understand what's going on. So again, the basic question is, the three-charge black hole is a complete classical smooth black hole, completely smooth at the horizon. And the question is, if we want to change the physics all the way up to the horizon, in fact, we want to argue the horizon vanishes. Microstates have no horizons. For such a big change, we need to find the source of that change, and that's what we want to talk about. But before we do that, let's just observe something about this particular metric which we made. Again, I'll call this the naive geometry. It was the classical geometry we wrote down for the three-charge system. The actual microstates we make might end up being different. Let's compute the length of this particular throat of this geometry. This is r equal to 0 where we found the horizon. And the metric we had constructed for this right in the first lecture, if you just look at the radial part of it, it looked like dr square over r square. I could use that to compute the length of this throat starting from some arbitrary point here, r1, down coming close to r equal to 0. I just put epsilon there as a cutoff. I'll take epsilon to 0 in a second. If I want that proper distance, I get dr over r, which is a log. So I get log r1 upon epsilon, and that's infinity. So this throat, in fact, has a proper length, which is infinite. That's actually a property of all extremal black holes, extremal classical black holes, even the ordinary Reifenstrom black hole. The length of this throat up to the horizon is infinite. Of course, the free fall for an observer, the proper time for an observer falling in, is finite. So you can still cross the horizon, go inside, and suffer at the singularities and so on if you move appropriately inside the diagram. But in fact, the proper length of this throat is actually infinite. So in fact, and at this place, nothing is going wrong. The S1 is constant, S3 is constant, T4 is constant, everything was a constant size. Well, if the throat is infinitely long, one thing you could do is you could put very long wavelength excitations in the throat, and even though there's a lot of redshift as you come from here, you can actually make things which have arbitrarily small energy. So you can put very long wavelength things in here, so you can hide in the throat very, very low energy excitations, as low energy as you want, so this whole system has no energy gap above the vacuum. If you call the state the vacuum, then any excitations there, they can be as low in energy as you like. Are these things reasonable? Is it reasonable for a black hole to have an infinite throat? Well, classically, it's a fine metric. And is it reasonable for it to have a zero energy gap? That just follows from the fact you saw an infinite throat. And I want to argue to you that that's not so reasonable. But just look at how you actually make the black hole. So we'll just take some brains. You know, we had taken D1 brains, D5 brains, and momentum. We should take large numbers of these. But large doesn't mean infinite. I just want to make a black hole, you know, of a certain size, maybe a few kilometers. I'll take these numbers to be big. 10 to the 6 is the biggest number I could think of, but you could put 10 to the 12. It makes no difference. Just take some big numbers over there. And the string coupling, we won't take it to be 0. We'll take it to be small because weak coupling is what we like to do. So we'll take some weak coupling. We'll take some large numbers here. And we'll imagine we can make a black hole. So it's very important. Numbers are not infinite. They're just some finite but large numbers. And that is supposed to make this kind of a black hole, which has a throat with some diameter. The diameter depends on these numbers, and then the infinite throat and the horizon. Now, there's something funny about this. We ask if it is reasonable that we could get this infinite throat. And think about it the following way. This coupling constant G, of course, in the theory, you can tune. That's coming from the dilaton. So here's my dilaton meter. As I start tuning it from 0 to 1, the coupling goes from 0 to 1. And let us see what happens to the state. The state is just a cluster of D1, D5, and momentum brains. And here's the state at 0 coupling. It is just some string state. Take D1 brains, D5 brains, some momentum modes, 0 coupling. It looks like some mess. Maybe it is string size. We don't know much about it. But there's some mess over there. Then you start increasing your crank. You start increasing your coupling G. And suppose I make it some small value, then you might imagine the metric around that will be deformed a little bit. You'll get a little bit of a throat beginning to form. And then you make G bigger. We had tried to make it 0.01. Okay, suppose you make it 0.01. Okay, you might think the throat would become somewhat longer. Well, it just looks like a continuous process. Can you sort of imagine that at some stage in this process, the throat would actually become strictly infinite? This looks like a continuous process. So if you look at it this way, it looks hard to imagine how you could start with a finite number of brains and get a strictly infinite throat. Or if you think of the issue of energy gap, a finite system like this has a non-zero energy gap of excitation. Any finite quantum system has a discrete next excitation level. As you start increasing the coupling, that can't suddenly become zero. A finite system doesn't usually have a continuous spectrum of excitations. So somehow it looks more reasonable the throat could be long, but should still be finite. If you're long but finite, then there's no horizon, and we would completely have to change the picture of the singularity, the horizon, and everything. So I think this argument is sort of interesting. It may not look very convincing because it was so rough, and we are trying to make a claim about the whole properties of black holes, but I invite you to sit over this and beat your head on it for a while, and if you can see a way around it, then do let me know. I find it quite strange, how would it happen that you would get an infinite throat by moving the coupling G from 0 up to a finite value? In any case, let us see what happens if we do get these finite throats. So we are trying to ask if this kind of naive three-charge metric, the usual Reichstein-Ostrom black hole, because the throat could actually become finite, and if we try to extrapolate our lessons from what we learned about two-charge, this throat would actually be capped off smoothly, and then there could be different shapes of caps, and different shapes of caps will give different microstates, and if you count them, you should get the entropy. That was our whole story. Suppose that whole story is true here also. If it worked perfectly well for two charges, if it also works for three charges, well, this is as good, as close to a classical black hole as you might like. You would then think the same story is true for all kinds of black holes. Well, in fact, there could be some kind of continuity between this and this. It looks so totally different, but there is a kind of continuity. We are saying the throat gets capped off, but we never said this thing has to be very short. Here it was infinite. Suppose the length of this throat was some power of n1, n5, np. Now that's the big number coming in the story. So it's logical to think it could be some power of n1, n5, np. That's a big number. In fact, if you put in the h bars in the problem, it's like some reciprocal power of h bar. In the limit h bar going to 0, this is really infinite. So perhaps what is happening is this throat, which was infinitely long in a naive approximation, if you go a distance 1 over h bar down the throat, you might find a cap. That is still a little continuous between here and here, because suppose somebody was only willing to go down to classical scales, if the diameter of this was 1 mile, you might agree to go down here 100 miles, 1,000 miles. But up to there, they'll both look the same. It's just that very far down, millions and millions of miles further down, this guy could cap off, and this would just be the wrong picture. But there's still some continuity between them, because even though this is quite different from this, this happens very, very far down, a distance 1 over h bar down, and so in the classical limit, infinitely far away. Well, if all this was true, what would we like to happen in particular? You remember in the last lecture what we did was, when we had all the different geometries differing near this cap ends, we cut it off here and we said if that's the boundary of the region where they differ from each other, the boundary of the messy region, if I cut it off there and measure the area, like here, and do area upon 4g, do I get the entropy? Well, this time we get lucky. Even without any calculations, I can tell you if you actually were to have this kind of a picture and you cut it here, the area there will give you the right entropy. So how do I know that without even doing the calculation? Because for the three-charge black hole, you remember, we did this metric explicitly in the first lecture, and we found that as you go down this throat towards r equal to 0, everything stabilized to constant values. The diameter of the S3 became a constant. It saturates to a constant. So the value of the S3 size here is the same as the value all the way down to r equal to 0. It stabilized. The T4 stabilized. The S1 stabilized. So in fact, the values here are pretty much the same as the values all the way down at r equal to 0. So if I cut it here and measure A over 4G, I get the same answer as we had in the first class. And that, of course, was the answer, which was known to match exactly with the microscopic entropy. So it's clear that all I need to do for the three charge, if I cut it here, automatically get the right A upon 4G, the ball size, the surface of the ball size will give me the right Bekenstein kind of law. All I need to know is, are the geometries really capped, or do they really have horizons, and you can fall through and find singularities? So let's see if we can actually make some geometries where you might be able to see something. We have not found any general way to make all three-charge geometries. We've just been able to make a few assorted classes, but those which we managed to make work perfectly fine. Just want to tell you about two of those classes. The first thing you might want to do, the D1, D5 two-charge system, now that we did in full detail. And so the first thing you would like to think about is how about we just add one unit of momentum charge. May not look like much, but if you can add one unit of momentum charge and get still a smooth capped geometry, at least it'll give you some faith that this whole idea that three-charge metrics are also smooth capped objects might have some validity. Well, this time, of course, because you're adding such a small amount of P, you simply have to solve the wave equation for perturbations. If you take this two-charge metric, you can take a little perturbation of supergravity fields and solve them perturbatively and see if you can add one unit of momentum by solving them. So in fact, if you you're trying to solve a wave function, we should have this kind of form. The y circle is the S1. If something goes like e to the iy, it has one unit of momentum in the y direction. Because I want it to be BPS, I also make it go like e to the it. So it has one unit of energy. So if the wave function had to describe a BPS excitation carrying one unit of momentum, the wave function should look like this. For other reasons coming from ADS safety duality, we also need that the fields which you have to use to make the perturbation are the NS-NS2 form field and the dilaton. And if you put all that together, you start solving the wave equation for this, you can see what problem you'll get into. You can always write a wave equation in a smooth geometry. But if you try to find a solution with the given answers, it'll either blow up here, or if you try to forcibly make it bounded here, it'll blow up on this side. Only if something very special happens will you get a state which is normalizable over here and also decaying on that side. That side is the flat space infinity side. If the theory really wants to have a smooth excitation carrying one unit of momentum, then and only then will you find such a normalizable excitation. So in fact, we solved it by matching the solution here to a solution here to several orders, and it works out beautifully. You actually get a solution which keeps matching from both sides, so the system does want to have one unit of momentum, and so you can see some kind of a glimpse that three charge states could also be completely smooth. They have caps. Actually, this particular state does not have a horizon. To make slightly more interesting states which had more momentum, we play a certain trick which uses the idea of spectral flow. So you might know what spectral flow is, and if you don't, you can just bypass this particular piece of this slide. I don't have that much to say about it because of lack of time. You recall this was our CFT. This was the T4 here and the S1 here, and we wrapped the NS5 brains on it, and we got an effective string coming out of this NS5 brains and D1, D5 system. So we had all the brains here, but the CFT living on these strings, these effective strings, were just the vibrations here, which is a CFT which has four bosons and four fermions. And the fermions around the circle could either be periodic or anti-periodic. It turns out that this particular CFT, the fermions are periodic, and so it's a CFT in the Ramond-Ramond sector. Both the left and right movers are periodic, so we say they are both the Ramond sector, so we say CFT is in the Ramond-Ramond sector. So in fact, the states we had last time, they were ground states of the Ramond sector on the left movers, ground states of the right movers, because we're not putting any excitations on them. We are not sending vibrations up or down unless we excite the system. And we had played with excitations last time, but right now this is just the unexcited state. Well, there's a way to make a particular excitation of this state called spectral flow. If you take the fermions and you start changing their boundary condition from being periodic continuously to antiperiodic, well, that brings them to the NS sector. But then also the vacuum in the process moves up to some state which has a higher value of the energy, a higher value of L0. But if you continue that process, of course, you'll come back to the periodic sector. So you'll come back to the Ramond sector, but not to the vacuum, but to some state which has an excitation level N. So you can start with the fermions being periodic, you twist boundary conditions till they become antiperiodic, and continue twisting till they are periodic again. If they're periodic again, of course, you are back in the sector where you want your states. That's your physical sector for the problem. But then, of course, now you've got a different state. So vacuum on left and vacuum on right movers becomes N on the left movers, some excited state, and the right movers are still unexcited. Now, the L0 minus L0 bar, the left moving energy minus right moving energy, up minus down, is non-zero, equal to N, and that's just the momentum charge. As you know, momentum, which tells you whether you're moving up or down, is L0 minus L0 bar, and this way you can make some particular states. Now, obviously, these are not the generic states you would like to make. Generic states would have arbitrary amounts of momentum or arbitrary sets of strings. You would like to do what you whatever you want to be a way of putting momentum on these strings. But it's a particular way to get momentum because you have some particular state which comes from spectral flow on the left, and the right mover, of course, should not be excited. For this particular state, it turns out to be possible to find the metric. And at this point, you should really close your eyes because if you see this, you may not like it. It's very big, but that doesn't matter. What I'm going to tell you about is its properties. I just want to show you that you can make these states. So the state, in fact, explicitly looks like this. And again, since I haven't told you much about the CFT, this is not supposed to make any particular amount of sense right now. You take the vacuum for the Ramond's ground state. You act with some of the current operators. It's a CFT. A CFT has LNs, GNs, and Js. If it's a CFT with n equal to 4 SUSY, which is what this is, you act with some excitation on the vacuum that excites the state. There are no right movers that stays in the ground state. So you know exactly which state in the CFT you have. You know exactly what excitations are running up the string, and there is the whole metric. See, I don't want you to see the metric. I just want you to see that the metric can be found. And the nice property about this metric, when you go and look at it, is that if you've done everything correctly and you've got all the numbers there exactly the way they should come from spectral flow, then you find this metric is completely smooth. It doesn't have any horizons, doesn't have any singularities, it doesn't have any closed time-like curves. It's very important to mention those three things because this class of metric is one of a general class found for rotating charged objects by Swethi Chen Yom. And if you put any arbitrary values of the parameters you see here, you see parameters QP, eta, A, lots of numbers coming around. If you put some generic values for those numbers, you always get either a horizon, a naked singularity, or a closed time-like curve. However, the actual values you get from spectral flow are very special values. You get very special energies, special angular momenta, special charges. You put all those in, and you're just skating at the edge. Everything closes up completely smoothly, and there's no singularity anywhere. So the theory seems to know exactly what it is doing. The actual microstates seem to have a dual geometry, which is completely smooth. Well, that's about all that we have been actually concretely able to do with three-charge geometries as far as making them is concerned. I think the most promising direction to learn more about three-charge systems might be through the direction of three-charge supertubes, where you can actually understand bound states of three charges better. I'm absolutely no expert on supertubes, but we might hear much more about that in the lectures of Matthias. I think it's really a promising direction. I do want to mention one curiosity which has been puzzling us in this context over the last few weeks. A supertube is just giving you some kind of a metric which might be the metric of a black ring. A ring has a shape of a donut. Well, these metrics I just showed you, they actually have a very high amount of angular momentum. So you would think that they would like to be black rings. They would like to be donuts. So we thought that because we actually have a metric here which is completely smooth, we thought we might actually therefore have found a metric which shows you what is inside a black ring. Because this is an actual microstate, it doesn't have a horizon. So you're wondering, did we actually manage to find the metric which solves the inside of a black ring, at least one of the metrics which might give a microstate of a black ring. It's very interesting that you don't succeed in that project, and we were quite disappointed we didn't succeed in that project. If you look at this metric, even though it has a large amount of rotation, a very high amount of rotation more than a normal black hole would support by classical arguments, you just can't find any sphere by which you can grab the donut to see that it is a ring. If you have a donut, you can get your hand around the donut, okay, and move it around. You need to get this particular S1 by which you can grab the donut, and this guy doesn't have such an S1. So there's something slightly more bizarre, which is not easy to visualize because these are all objects in 4+1, and our intuition of what rotation does may not be so good. But because of this fact we just mentioned, even though I think black rings and supertubes might be the place where we'll finally be able to learn more about three charge, we should always maintain in our mind the fact, just remember this fact, that perhaps what the objects we are getting might be even more bizarre. They may not have a ring-like structure. They sometimes seem to be objects which we really can't understand either as rings or anything simple like that. Yes. Yes. That's an interesting question, and the answer is yes and no. In the normal black hole, of course, there's this sphere which comes down and then becomes the horizon. So you don't contact any further because you reach the horizon. That's in the black hole metric. That's the sphere you're talking about, right? Right, and so when you come to the smooth geometries, when you take the sphere at infinity and you start coming in, that particular sphere is still non-contractible. The only problem is that sphere gets mixed up with the other directions, and so that's not the sphere which carries the charge. There's a twist. The sphere at infinity is not the sphere of the ADS3 cross S3 because you have to mix with the S1 and two different projections work inside and outside. So this all this twisting about, it's very closely connected to what I was just trying to say. What you might think is the sphere at infinity is not the sphere which is inside. And somehow for the same reason or perhaps similar reasons, we just couldn't locate that particular sphere or the particular circle by which we would be able to see how this is a black ring. We very much wanted to do that because if we could see how this guy was a black ring, we would be able to measure dipole charges. You can't define dipole charges. Here's a guy with a high amount of rotation, it's a three-charge object. We couldn't define dipole charges, and we are very puzzled about that. So maybe we can talk about that. Other questions? Okay, any more questions on this? Because I'm going to switch gears and move to the next topic. So all I'll say about these three charts before moving on is that I think the real thing left to do is to find the generic three chart geometry. Perhaps the supercube ideas may help us, or the black rings ideas may help us, or just pursuing these other CFD directions might teach us more about how to make generic three chart geometries. But if we can make a generic three chart geometry, and we find that also to be capped in this kind of a fashion, I think that basically would probably seal it. After that, it's very hard for the black hole problem to really have any other direction to go, because this is a very generic classical black hole. Okay, so I think in some sense, a really important part of the issue lies in trying to complete that calculation. Okay, so let's go on and talk about this second topic which I had mentioned. How do we understand space-time? So it's something I've been curious about all the while since ADS-CFT came up. Now you have a dual gauge theory. In this case, it's a 1+1 dimensional CFT. In ADS-5 plus S-5, it's a Yang-Mills theory. And so what's happening here? Let's go back to our picture of the CFT. On the gravity side, you just have some kind of a throat and a cap and flat space. So we know the Sugra side perfectly well. What do you see on the CFT side? So you have all the little component strings, and they're wrapped up into lots of these little loops. And the total winding number of these strings adds up to N1, N5. We talked about that last time. And all the different states of the CFT come from different ways of joining them up. One long piece, lots of short pieces, some short and some long. You count them, that's the entropy. They give rise to different caps, each state, one geometry, and you go from there. But if you look at the number of these component strings out here, in any given macrostate, that's a finite number. If I made them all into single circles, there would be N1 and 5 of them. If I make them all into one long loop, there would be just one of them. Does that number mean something? On this side, if I join them all up into one piece, you remember the throat was very long. If I kept them all into separate pieces, the throat was very short. Okay. But you look at a short throat or you look at a long throat, do you see this number somewhere? Does a short throat really have something, N1, N5 units of something in it? Does a very long throat have only one unit of something in it? Well, in some sense, if you want to make some mental picture, if you take a little sheet of rubber, it's fairly thick, and then start stretching it out to make it long, what will happen to the sheet of rubber? Well, it will become longer because you pulled it, but it'll also become thinner. Okay, so perhaps space-time really has such a property. Normally, we don't think so. Space-time is just a manifold. So if you stretch out the manifold, there's nothing like saying a manifold gets thinner. A manifold is just an abstract surface. But let's think about it, because we might find something similar actually coming out when we look at ADS-CFT duality. And let me just show you a few calculations which are suggestive. Just want to look at them, and then maybe go back and think about them. Okay, so here I want to take you back to this absorption process that we talked about last time. This was an interesting part of the whole dynamics of the D1, D5 system. You send a graviton or one of these other massless quanta of the theory onto the string. It gets absorbed onto the string, and one vibration mode goes up, one vibration mode goes down, and so the energy gets transferred into vibrating the string. In the dual picture, the same graviton which was coming, there's no string to see, but it can just fall down the hole. And then the time it spends in the hole, the time to go around the circle, we had the whole story there. But now let us be a little more precise about this calculation. Let's look at a few details that last time we skipped over. In particular, we want to see what is this quantum which went in. If I had solved a wave equation for this guy going in and out, I told you last time we just solved a wave equation, but the wave equation I wrote down was just box phi equals zero, a massless minimally coupled scalar. Well, I have to use some scalar which is in the theory, in type to be string theory, in this background, so which scalar did I have in mind? I'll have to really pick up a particular scalar because you have to do all this properly and rigorously. So what was this quantum which actually fell in? So what is the quantum that fell in? So let's go and look at the massless scalars in this geometry. Since you know the supergravity equation, it's not hard to figure out what are the massless scalars in this problem. And here they are. If you take the torus T4, remember the torus was T4, I'll call the coordinates x1, x2, x3, x4. These are capital X's. I think earlier I had called them z1, z2, z3, z4, but right now I just call them capital X's. And then for example, some massless scalars you can get by doing this. Take the graviton of type 2B string theory and let the graviton have indices I and j along the T4. Now, you know, if you put the indices of the graviton in the compact direction T4, it becomes a scalar in the non-compact transverse direction. So there, that's a scalar. And if you take the Ramond-Ramond B field, for example, again, that has indices I and J. If you put the indices I and J in the compact direction, well, that also makes scalars. Let's just go and look at these scalars, because these scalars in particular are minimal massless, minimally coupled scalars in this background, and they are the ones I was actually using in this wave equation, box phi equals zero. So now at least we know which scalars they are. And so now let's also be a little more precise about this coupling. How does this particular scalar come and couple and make vibrations going up and down? What do we mean by saying how does it make the vibrations? Of course, the string is going to vibrate, but we said the string had vibrations just in the torus directions. This is the T4 direction. And along the T4, there are only four directions, x1, x2, x3, x4. So if we have a vibration of the string, I should tell you in which direction the string vibrating. It's a transverse vibration, so I have to give you the polarization of the vibration. Could be vibrating in direction x1, could be vibrating in direction x2, and so on. I have to give you the polarization. Well, in fact, this is the coupling. If you go and figure out the coupling, it's very simple. Hij, if the indices are I and j, it couples to del xi, del bar xj. Del and del bar mean t plus y and t minus y. So this is a vibration going up, and this is a vibration going down. Left movers, right movers. So the picture is rather clear. If you get an object H, let's say 1, 2 coming in, it will excite a vibration of direction 1 going up and direction 2 going down. But of course, Hij is symmetric. So in fact, you also have an equal amount of vibration in direction 2 going up and 1 going down. Is that okay? The most symmetric simple thing you could write is the coupling. Now, Bij, of course, is anti-symmetric. And so no surprise, this time you get the minus. And we could play directly with the H and the B. But a little bit more convenient to make combinations of them, S plus ij, which is h plus b, and S minus, which is h minus b. And the point of that is then, of course, the coupling is very simple. If you have S plus 1, 2, it will make vibration in direction 1 going up and direction 2 going down. And that's it. I don't have to worry about the other fact. There's also a piece where 2 is going up and 1 is going down. So just easier for me to work with these. But if you wanted any stage, you could switch back and just talk of gravitons if you like. Okay, so I'll just talk about this guy's S plus. I'm just gonna use these. And so here's the picture of what an S plus does. If you send an S plus 1, 2 in there, which means a little bit of H12, a little bit of B12 superposed, then in fact it creates a vibration going up the string, that means this way around the string, polarized in direction X1, and this way around the string, polarized in direction X2. And on the gravity side, all you see is this quanta S12 has gone into the throat. Is this okay? Any questions on this one? I'm gonna be using this on the next couple of slides. So now we know a little bit more about how the vibrations happen, what the coupling is, what the polarization is. And now you see we'll run into a seeming problem. And so let's look at the problem. So let's take the CFT state. The CFT, we had the string wrapped N1, N5 times. We had all those choices. We could make one circle, join them all up into one long circle, or have lots of short circles. I'll take the case where it's all joined into one long component string. Can I take that case? One long component string like this. And now instead of putting only one quanta in the throat, how about I throw in two quanta in the throat? If one quanta was fun, then two quanta should be twice as much fun. So I'm going to put two quanta in that throat, and let's see what happens. So the first quanta I throw in the throat is this S12, and the other quanta, let's say, is S34. So you remember what 1 and 2 meant? It just means a graviton with indices 1 and 2, and same with the B field. And this is a graviton with indices 3, 4, and the same with the B field. So I have two quanta like this. And let's see what it actually does for me on the string. When you throw this S12 in this object, it makes a vibration direction 1 going up and a vibration direction 2 going down. And this S34, it makes a vibration direction 3 going up and a vibration direction 4 going down. So does that look reasonable? So now what do I have on the string? I have two vibrations running clockwise on the string, and two vibrations running anti-clockwise on the string, and the vibrations which are going clockwise have positions x1 and x3, and the ones going anti-clockwise have positions x2 and x4. I'll also assume these two have the same energy, so in fact, they all have the same wavelength. They can all be, let's say, in the lowest harmonic of the string. But now you see, let's look at a different configuration, where in the throat, I put in S14 and S32. I wanted to see the fact that on the gravity side, this object is quite different from this object. A graviton indices 1, 4, with indices 1, 4, had nothing to do with the graviton indices 1, 2, or a graviton indices 3, 4. It's a completely different particle. So this guy has nothing to do with this. But nevertheless, when it actually lands up on the string in the CFT picture, see what it does. The S14 makes a 1 going up and a 4 going down, and the S32 makes a 3 going up and a 2 going down. It's exactly the same. That's very bad. Perhaps everything I was telling you was wrong, because if two different supergravity states map to the same CFT state, there can't be any ADS CFT duality, or maybe I set up the duality wrong. We should have a one-to-one map, otherwise it doesn't mean anything. Is this a problem? Because notice one thing, if instead of having one long component string, if I had two component strings, then I wouldn't have this problem. Because then this 1 and 2 could write on the first string, and the 3 and 4 could write on the second string, and then there would be no confusion. I just want to put that down on the next slide, because that's an important issue. Okay, so if we had two component strings, it would be okay. Here's one component string, here's the other component string. The X1, X2 write on the first string, the X3, X4 write on the second string. There's no confusion. Nobody's saying there's a particle H32 in the system or H14 in the system. The first graviton is 1, 2, second graviton is 3, 4, and you can read off the indices. But if somebody put 3 quanta in the throat, you'd be in trouble, because the third quanta must either write here or write here, and again you have a problem. So it's very funny. If you have a graviton, then this is HIJ. What happens when it actually hits the string, the I and J sort of get cut up. The I goes one way and the J goes the other way. That's the absorption. This is the model of absorption we've used in black holes and got all the absorption gray body factors working all through these years. So we trust this model of how things get absorbed, and yet we seem to find a paradox. And then you can now take it more generally. Suppose you had M component strings, M pieces. As long as you had up to M quanta, it's okay. You could put the first quanta here, second quanta here, third quanta here. But if somebody gave you M plus 1 quanta, you wouldn't know what to do, because the last guy has to share somebody who's already occupied, and then you have the same paradox. So it's clear what the problem is. The duality map is not working very well. But we don't right now want to do with it, but before we move on from here and try to see what we could possibly do with it, let's just compute the energy which you will have to put to excite every component string once. Okay, if you excite only one string once like we were doing last time, that's just some amount of energy. But now we're talking of exciting all the component strings once. How much energy does that cost us? Well, suppose there are M component strings, there's a factor of M. I wrote that here. For each component string, I'm going to have one guy going up, one guy going down. That's this factor of 2. And for each guy vibrating there, I'll just assume it's in the lowest harmonic. And so I get 2 pi over the length of the string. If L is the length of the box, K was the winding number of each component string, you get 2 pi over the length of the string. So that's the energy of each mode going up or down. 2 account for the up and the down, M account for number of component strings. It's a one-line calculation. Everything is very simple in the CFT. So if I have more energy than this, I'm certainly going to run into some trouble, because all my strings are used up. I try to put in some more quanta, I have problems. With less energy than this, I'm okay. Does this energy actually have some meaning on the gravity side? Because the CFT side, this thing is really showing us the discreteness of the problem. There are only M component strings. Now, M could be a large number. The total amount of winding here is N1, N5. In a generic state, there'll be root N1, N5 pieces, each with winding number root N1, N5. If you have numbers like root N1, N5 number of pieces, we are talking of a large number of quanta. But in any case, the CFT is showing us, if you put too many quanta, the map seems to be breaking down. What is happening on the gravity side? Well, so let's look at the gravity side. So on the gravity side, what we have done is, so far, we have ignored back reaction. What's the meaning of saying we ignored back reaction? Well, of course, we throw some matter, some energy into this throat, we saw it went in, and it just bounced off. But it doesn't have to be like that. If you start taking the back reaction of this guy into account, then the throat might deform. We've got to check, when is the back reaction important? When does it become significant? Let's go and ask that question. Is there an easy way to figure this? Well, again, using the standard old work on black holes, you can figure out how to compute this. So for example, if you just took even the naive two-charge geometry, if you threw some extra energy delta E into it, delta E is just some extra energy which you just throw into the black hole, you know it'll make a horizon somewhere. This is all normal classical thinking, no microstates, nothing, it'll make a horizon. And what you could ask is, at what radius r would it make the horizon? If the energy was very small, you'll make the horizon at r equal to 0. A tiny horizon here. If you put a lot of energy, you get a horizon way up here. In fact, the exact formula is, the radius at which you make the horizon is connected to the amount of energy you put in by some kind of a formula like this, depending on all the couplings and moduli. So, okay, but then using this, we can estimate when the back reaction actually becomes important. So how do you estimate that? Suppose the amount of energy you put is quite small, delta E too small, I wrote over here. If you put a small amount of energy, it's gonna go down the throat and slosh up, because with that much energy, horizon would have appeared over here. So if you had a geometry going up there, you put energy, you would have made a horizon, but because you have a small amount of energy, it just bounces off from here. Okay. On the other hand, if you put too much energy and you have tried to make a horizon way up here, then it doesn't help that here there was a cap, it'll just come here and make your horizon. The whole geometry is destroyed. So what is the critical amount of energy at which the back reaction becomes just about order one? Well, that's clear. If the radius RH at which the horizon would form from that much energy, take the amount of energy you have in mind, if the radius RH where the horizon would have come, if that's the place where the cap comes, then you are just at the critical point. If the cap was further down, you would make a horizon there. If the cap was way up, the matter will never get deep enough to make a horizon. There's just too little energy, it will just slosh back. So you can actually compute for every geometry a delta E, a threshold value, computed in supergravity. So we just call it delta E threshold in supergravity. It's the energy for which the back reaction becomes order one, and this is the criteria. You put RH equal to the value of radius of the cap, and you find when the back reaction becomes order one. Well, that's an energy delta E, and I put it right here on the right side of this equation. And surprisingly, what you find is we had also an energy on the left side of that equation, on the previous slide, which I put on the left side of the equation, a delta T in the CFT, and you find these two are equal. This is an estimation, really weird twiddle, up to factors of order unity. They all behave the same. And again, you find the same kind of magic. In the CFT, you just find pure, simple numbers. Here you have all these kinds of moduli, L, V, G, R, alpha prime, everything, and everything just cancels out. So it's one of those other clean things which you think must have some kind of a meaning, but right now the meaning is very obscure. We don't understand it, so on the next slide, we'll try to understand what this might mean. But right now, let's be clear that we understand what we have done. On the CFT, we kept adding energy till each of the strings was excited once. We saw how much energy that meant. We went to the gravity side, to the same throat which corresponded to that particular set of strings, and we said we keep adding energy till we find the deformation becomes order one because of back reaction of these quanta. If there's back reaction, you can't simply solve the wave equation, compute time delays like that. The whole geometry will change. And those two energies have come out to be comparable. So let us see if using this, we can perhaps get some kind of a picture of what space-time might have to do, what the structure of space-time might be. So again, this is a little bit of philosophy we're trying to put on the calculation. The calculation I showed you on the previous slide, you can just work through it. The only beauty you'll see is all these G's and alpha primes and V's and L's will just cancel out. And then we have to interpret what we have understood. And this is how I would like to picture the whole thing. So what does it mean? So again, here the picture is here. On the CFT side, we have these component strings. If they're all very, very short strings, we'll get a short throat. If they're multiply wound strings, then fewer of them, we'll have a longer throat, and so on. Suppose you put one quantum in the throat, like here. Then on the CFT side, it's equal to exciting one component string. We already saw that. You put vibration on the string, and then out here, you find that you've got one quantum in there. And that was the old story. But now, suppose you put another quantum in the throat. What are you gonna do? We talked about that. You excite another string. So you can see here, you're just putting quanta, and when you put quanta in this room, it doesn't look like the room will get used up. You can just put one quanta here, another quanta here, another quanta here. The room can hold as many quanta as you like, you might think. But the CFT is keeping track of what you're doing, and one by one, as you start putting quanta in this throat, the CFT strings are being used up, okay? So you put another quantum, you excite a different component string, and you keep going that way. What starts happening when all the component strings are used up? You have no more strings, and you have to reuse something you already used. But at that same amount of energy when you've used all the strings, you'll find you can no longer happily put another quanta in this throat because now there are so many quanta in the throat, they'll completely change the structure of the throat. The geometry will deform. So in fact, we are seeing something about the property of space and time. And in fact, I want to make just kind of a nice picture. You may not like this picture very much, but again, I would like to think of space-time as having some kind of like a rubber sheet, which has not only a shape, but some kind of thickness. It doesn't actually have a physical thickness, we know that, but some kind of an abstract thickness. Because now you see what is happening. Suppose I had a metric where I took lots and lots of these component strings, all singly wound. Then how many of them were there? There were N1, N5 of them. The throat was very short. It's like a rubber sheet which hasn't been stretched very much. How many quanta can I safely put in it? Well, N1, N5 of them. Okay, that's a lot of quanta. So it's like as if I had a thick kind of rubber sheet. The spacetime had a lot of different layers in it. And each time you put a particle, it goes into one of those layers. And lots of different particles, they all live on different layers. In the CFT, they live on different component strings. We don't think of it that way when you look at this room here. You see one photon, another photon, they seem to be occupying the same space. But if you actually go and look in the CFT, they're actually occupying different component strings. You have to somehow see what that means. But now if I join them all up into, let's say, just two component strings, then see what the, how it happens. I get a very long throat this time. We saw we get long throats when we have fewer component strings, because time of travel on the component string was time of travel in the throat and all that kind of story. But now if I put only two quanta in the throat, the backrest will completely distort the throat. So now it's as if I have stretched the rubber sheet a lot. The rubber sheet did become long because I made a long throat, but somehow it has a poorer quality, because only two quanta is all it can support before it deforms. So deformation, of course, is gravitational back reaction. That's the effect of gravity in some sense. Occupying string just looks like counting bits and then just using them up and throwing them out when they are used up. But somehow there's a close relation between them. And so somehow when you end up using all your component strings, you make an order one deformation of the geometry. There's a little postscript to add to this, which you might be thinking about while I was talking about this. Even if I have only two quanta, why can't they land up on the same string? I may have lots of strings there. Suppose I have three, and suppose I put just two quanta, I might put both of them on the same component string. What about that? Well, you can compute the probability for that. When you send some graviton in, there's some probability for it to land up on. You can find a wave function. It's spread over all the strings. You send another graviton. It spreads over all the strings. The probability that both the excitations are on the same string is 1 over the number of component strings, 1 over m. Does that have a possible interpretation on the gravity side? If you go to the gravity side, we just put one quanta in, you put another quanta in, the quanta just bouncing up and down the throat. We never took their gravitational interaction between them into account, but if you were actually going to compute what's the gravitational interaction strength between two different quanta in the throat, you'll actually find you again get a number like 1 over m. So how does that happen? If you've played with ADS5 cross S5, it might be familiar to you that the strength of the gravitational interaction is 1 over capital N. So in fact, the N, which comes in, which counts the pure number, which counts the number of degrees of freedom in your Yang-Mills, is the strength of gravity in all ADS kind of situations. And here, in fact, it's the number of component strings. It's the 1 over M. So by adding this postscript, we see that, in fact, whenever two guys ride on the same string, that's how they gravitationally interact. Quanta which are not interacting, to the extent they're riding on different strings, they don't interact. To the extent they may ride on the same string, well, that's the strength by which they do interact. If you have so many quanta that two of them have to be on the same string, the property is order one, that they have to be on the same string because you've used up all the strings, the gravity is really strong and the whole geometry distorts. So in fact, in some sense, this does give you a picture of how space-time is made of discrete pieces. But discrete pieces are not directly in space. I remind a little bit of what Nari Saibu was talking about in the last lecture about how you can have lots of different non-local representations of what space are. And often people have thought of space as being local discrete bits like this. But that's not quite how it comes. Each of these component strings describe motions all the way up and down. So totally all over the throat. It's not like here or there. But overall in the whole space-time, there is a kind of discreteness which is keeping track of what's the maximum number of particles you can safely put in the throat before the throat gives up. So I don't have anything else to say about that. Let me see if anybody has any comments about it, because just one of these bizarre things. It's one of these bizarre things which come up and give you very neat formulae where all the parameters cancel out. So it is something which really is begging for interpretation. And here I've tried to put some words on what we think it might end up meaning. Is there any questions on this? Yes. 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 Yeah, I'm not completely sure. If you want the quanta to not see each other for a long time before they travel on the string, you'll have to assume that their wave packets on the string are rather short compared to the total length of the string. Right now, when I was counting the amount of energy I was putting on the component string, I put it in the lowest harmonic on the component string, so it was the wavelength was equal to the whole length of the string. Then, of course, the two are just seeing each other directly. As you put more and more energy, other effects are actually going to trigger off. You have what is called a twist deformation of the CFT, which the strings don't have to be the same length. They can cut and join each other because of dynamical interactions, and you have to worry about all those issues. I think just at the leading order, by just counting the lowest possible energies, then you see that there already is a problem, and something has to change at that when you put that many quanta. What exactly has to change? You have to understand that. You have to exactly go into the kind of things, into more details like you were asking. OK, so let me switch gears and move to the next thing. And that's this whole idea of fractionation. I had mentioned in the last class that I would think of this as a very key issue on how objects end up getting bigger. And so let's talk a little bit slowly about how things might work with fractionation. So let's first go and make a little bit of a review of what I would call near extremal entropy. So far, we have only computed the entropy of extremal objects. But a near extremal object is something where you take a BPS object, which has mass equal to charge, and you add a little bit extra mass, but no more charge. So it's not extremal anymore. E is a bit bigger than Q, and you make a near extremal object. And in the whole story of black holes, near extremal objects have always worked pretty much as well as extremal objects as far as things like entropy and radiation go. So let's talk a little bit about how the story of near extremal objects went. Let's just remind ourselves about what we first did with extremal objects. So D1, D5 extremal, the entropy was 2 pi root 2 root N1, N5. We got that in the last class. And the picture was like this. You have your component strings, total winding numbers N1 and 5, different ways to partition N1 and 5, number of partitions is what gives you this entropy. Then we move to D1, D5, and P, and suppose you try to add one unit of P charge, the momentum, onto this object. So you have to add momentum going up these strings. And now you will ask, I should add the momentum to which of the possible microstates of the two-charge system. I could, for example, have had the two-charge state where they were all single circles. At the other extreme, I could have had a two-charge state where it was all one very long string. Should I try to add the momentum to this guy, or should I try to add the momentum to this guy? Well, in principle, you can add the momentum to either of them, and of course, the total mass and charge would be the same in either case. But in fact, you can easily see you get many more states by first bunching these up into one piece and then adding the momentum, and that is easy to see. Suppose these were all single circles, and suppose you were just adding one unit of momentum, what can you do? You can put the momentum on any one of those strings. The strings are identical. It's actually all the same state. Doesn't matter on which one you put the momentum, and that's it. So there's only one state. But with that same one unit of momentum, if you put it on the string which is wrapped so many times around, then of course the story is now familiar to you. This circle has length L, but if I were to unwrap the string to its covering space, it has a length L total, LT, which is equal to in length N1 times N5. And so this momentum 2 pi, if I put NP units of momentum, 2 pi NP over L, my momentum, I can rewrite on this completely long string as 2 pi over LT and N1 N5 NP. And so in fact, because the vibrations come in these fractional units of 1 over N1 N5, that's why there are so many of these units. And because these units can now be partitioned in different ways among the harmonics, the entropy came out to be a rather big number, N1 N5 NP, and not just partitions of NP. So that was our old story about entropy. But the point I want to emphasize right now is that when you join them all up into one piece, that's when you get these fractional units, and the momentum is in fractional units because the length of the string is much longer. This particular issue actually has a lot to do with how we understand that black holes work with fractionation, because otherwise, in fact, there's an immediate contradiction to making black holes out of brains in string theory. So suppose you take a lot of charges, put them together, and you make a very big black hole. Suppose the black hole is a mile wide. Suppose you throw a quanta on it of wavelength half a mile, what will happen to the quanta? Of course, it will go into the black hole. So a black hole which is a mile wide can easily absorb quanta, which are, let's say, a meter, 100 meters, half a mile wide. They just fall into the black hole. But if the black hole was just made of little strings wrapped in a compact direction, this is an S1, one of the compact directions of our space-time, you would normally think of the compact directions as having a length, like Planck length, string length, something microscopic. And if all you could do was excite vibrational such a string, what's the minimum amount of energy you require to excite a string whose length is Planck length? Well, you'll have to have at least Planck mass, or in fact, the wavelength of the particle would have to be Planck length. Anything lower than that wouldn't be able to be absorbed by a string which has length wrapped only on a circle of length L Planck. So how can a big black hole absorb quanta? When the quanta is absorbed, you just get vibration going up and down the string. How can a big black hole absorb low energy, long wavelength quanta? Well, so this is the secret. All the strings join up into one long string. The more quanta you put in the black hole, the longer the string becomes. And the longer it becomes, the lower the wavelength you can support on the string, and therefore the lower the quanta that you can absorb. And if you work out these numbers, which were done by Malthusian and Susskind in 96 or 97, it works out very beautifully. The quanta which you expect the black hole would absorb sort of agrees very well with the length of this effective string. So anyway, this you can already see the effect of fractionation being very important for understanding the dynamics of black holes. But we are going to use it for a slightly different purpose. For that, let us just play a little bit more with this game of how black holes and strings absorb energy. And so let's do it this way. We take d1, d5, no momentum, and just add a little bit of extra energy. Just throw some energy onto it, but no momentum. Where does the energy go? Well, here's the string which I had drawn before. If I have no net momentum, but I want to add energy, well, this is what I could do. I would have some vibrations running clockwise along the string, going up the string, and some vibrations running anti-clockwise along the string, going down the string. Now, there's no net momentum. If the amount of this energy and this energy are equal, there's no net momentum, but you have managed to add energy. So if you take d1, d5 and add energy, what you get is d1, d5 plus p and p bar. P bar means anti-momentum modes. They're going this way around the circle. P means momentum modes going that way around the circle. So d1, d5 plus energy gives d1, d5 plus pp bar. Does that look reasonable? Okay. It's very important because everything we're going to say, this will actually be used very critically. The important point about the pp bar modes is the p and p bar modes come in fractional units. Again, to emphasize the point, the whole string has a length n1, n5, so they don't come in units of 2 pi over L, which would be natural if they were separately running in space, but because they're bound to the string, they come in these fractional units, and this statement will be important on the next slide. But in any case, one thing becomes clear from this. If you take d1, d5, and add some extra energy, you make a near-extremal system. It's no longer extremal. It has a little bit more energy than extremality. But it's easy to work out the entropy of that system. You have some left movers going up the string. You have right movers going down the string. But in fact, since left movers don't talk to the right movers, I would simply add the entropy of the left movers to the entropy of the right movers. And so from the left movers, I get 2 pi root n1 n5 np as before. And from the other side, I get 2 pi root n1 n5 np bar. And if I just add this, I'll get the entropy of a system which has d1, d5, and a little bit of extra energy. It's not extremal, but I can still write the entropy in a very simple way. And if you go back and compute the horizon area of a black hole, which is not just extremal, but extremal plus a bit of extra energy, it agrees beautifully. This was shown by Karen Malthus in 96, a little bit after the work of Strominger and Wafa. Near extremal entropy works out as well as extremal entropy. So these numbers actually play out perfectly well. They agree down to the last factor of 2. And I want to remind you of the study of near extremal entropy, because it's exactly this kind of data that near extremal entropy works out, which I'm now going to take from here and use for a different purpose. Our purpose is to estimate size. Entropy is just a matter of counting, and these are all nice countings, but we want to use what we learn from these countings and apply them to estimate the sizes of objects. So that's the direction which we are going, but right now we just need to pick up some of these older tools to understand what's going on. So okay, after that somewhat boring intro to this story, I want to ask you a question. And so here's the question I'd like you to focus on. Take NS1 and P. So that just NS1 is just the fundamental string. It's wrapped on a circle. P is momentum, so I put some momentum on the circle. A string carrying vibrations along the string, along itself. We've seen this many times now, so nothing new about it. But now here's the question. I want to throw some extra energy onto this. No extra momentum, just some extra energy. What's going to happen? Well, perhaps you might say this is a logical answer. If you excite a string, in fact, if you took an ordinary string in the lab, even if there was momentum running up the string, if you put some extra energy on the string, what happens? You get more vibrations, some going up the string and some going down. Because you didn't add any net momentum, the amount of vibrations going up will be equal to the amount going down, but that's all that will happen. Those are the standing waves on the string, and that's how you'll absorb the energy. So NS1P, after adding some energy delta E, adds P and P bar. Does that look reasonable? looks reasonable, but we're going to come back in a while and argue that this is not going to be always right. But just focus on this for now, because it looks reasonable from what we have said. While we do that, let's also ask ourselves, what's the minimum amount of energy that you can put on the string in this process? Well, if you send a vibration going clockwise on the string, its energy is 2 pi over the length of the string. Length of the string is n1, the wrapping number, times the length of that surface. 2 pi over n1l is the energy of the clockwise mode. 2 pi over n1l is the energy of the anticlockwise mode. Total is 4 pi over n1l. So you can see 1 power of n1 in the denominator. If the string was longer, the threshold of excitation is lower, our old story. With only 1 power of n1 at the bottom, we'll see soon that you could do other things, get more powers of n1, but this is a formula I want you to remember because we plan to come back to this. Okay, so now let's try something else. Let's take the D1, D5 system and add the energy delta E. We talked about that about one or two slides ago. And let's see what we had agreed to. If you have D1, D5, and you add some E, some energy delta E, you get vibrations going up the component string, vibrations going down the component string, so you get D1, D5 plus PP bar. And just to remind ourselves again, I've put in here brackets the factor 1 over N1, N5, so the PP bar come in fractional units of 1 over N1, N5. We remember that from two slides ago. And now in the last slide, we were arguing about this issue. If I take P and NS1, NS1P, and I add the energy to it, where does it go? Well, we had a logical answer pictorially. It should make PP bar pairs. But on the other hand, suppose I take what I had on the first line and I apply dualities. You remember that by dualities, you can take D1, D5, and P, and you can permute them. In particular, if you do dualities, the D1 charge becomes P, the D5 charge becomes NS1. We had those dualities. Energy, of course, remains energy. So D1 has become P, D5 has become NS1. I'm just trying to write this line just by using dualities. What happens to P under the same dualities? If D1 goes here and D5 goes here, the P goes to NS5. Now that's completely bizarre. If D1, D5 made PP bar pairs and we agree to that, it would seem that P, NS1, just a fundamental string carrying vibrations, should make NS5, NS5 bar pairs. And again, they should come in fractional units. If this was 1 over N1, N5, this should be 1 over N1, NP. What on earth does this mean? How can something carry excitations of NS5, NS5 bar brains? A couple of things odd about this. Firstly, we don't know what fractional brains might mean like this. Also, NS5 brains look quite heavy. What's the mass of an NS5 brain? There's a 1 over G square in it. These are very heavy objects. Why would the energy like to go into objects which have a mass so big there's a G square in the bottom? Well, let's see what's the minimum energy required to excite a pair of NS5, NS5 bar. You can see the 1 over G square in the mass of an NS5 brain. This is the mass of an NS5 brain. I put the 2 because I have to make the NS5, NS5 bar pair. But here is the important thing I want you to notice. We've agreed they have to come in fractional units. We don't know how to visualize these fractional units of NS5 brains, but just by duality we know it must be like this. You should get units like 1 over N1NP. Okay, but now you see something funny. This 1 over G square is bothering us. At weak coupling, at least, is a very heavy object. But if you have large numbers N1, NP, then the total mass you have for the excitation may not be very large at all. So let us see what really happens. From the previous slide, we saw if we add P and NS1, if we just made PP bar pairs, just vibrate the string, just mechanical physics 101 intuition, the minimum energy of excitation was 4 pi over N1. And now the energy of excitation we make NS, for the same guy, if you add energy to make NS5 bar pairs, this is the energy, which is cheaper. Whichever is cheaper is what will happen, and let's figure out which is cheaper. So this guy has a 1 over G square in the bottom. So at very small g, g equal to 0, obviously this is very heavy, infinite, so this is cheaper. So this is what you will get, PNS1 and PP bar pairs. Is it okay? At small g, that's what you'll get. At larger g, this one has two ends at the bottom. This has only one end at the bottom. Even when G becomes a little bit larger, this can soon start to win over. And so in fact, to P NS1, if you add some energy, you will get NS5, NS5 bar pairs. So I wrote it here. At some G critical, there'll be a transition. You can set this equal to this and find out what is G critical. Okay. But already we are seeing that these bizarre things have to be considered, because if I increase G beyond a certain value, these guys are lighter. These absolutely bizarre fractional brains turning out to be lighter. What is the meaning of this G critical? Well, it turns out if you go and look at another old piece of black hole literature, there's something called the Horowitz-Polchinski phase transition. And what was their idea? If you go to a very weak coupling and you take some string, it is just a state of a string. Just, you can just look at a string in flat space. At some critical value, if gravity becomes strong enough, you should start to think of it like a black hole. So there's a string or matter phase of everything, and then there's a black hole phase for the same amount of mass. And somewhere in between, there'll be a transition. So there'll be a transition to some intermediate value of g. At g equals 0, it's a free string. At g larger, it's a black hole. What's the critical g at which things become a black hole? And you work it out, and you find that's the same g critical. So what have we learned here? We have learned that if we want to talk about black holes, if you want g to be big enough to make us a black hole, if you take a string ns1 and p and you put energy on it, you don't just vibrate the string. You actually make fractional 5-5 bar pairs stuck to the string. We can't visualize this. We just got this by duality. But already we can see that there are some stages of our intuition which we need to develop, which we are not otherwise used to from our normal physics 101 way of thinking about strings. You think of a string, you put energy, you make the string longer, make it vibrate more. The physics are not there. If you're actually in the black hole phase, something completely different happens. Do we have any faith that this is the right answer? This might look like an argument which is not all that convincing because the answer is so bizarre. But in fact, there was a good reason why one arrived at this answer. One was looking for it. One looking for it for the following reason. There's something called gray body factors in emission. If you take this particular string state, and then you throw something on it or let it radiate back out, make it non-extremal and radiate back out, well, that's what we want to compare to the properties of black holes, and that's called gray body factors of black hole emission, which are worked out in great detail in the mid-90s. It turns out if you take an NS1P system and you add energy, and the energy makes PP bar pairs, and the PP bar pair can annihilate and radiate, you get some radiation, but has all the wrong properties. Nothing makes any sense. Actually, D1, D5, and delta E, everything was making perfect sense. That's how, in fact, the near-extremal black hole radiation was done, and all the factors fit absolutely beautifully. And in fact, the moment you realize that the dual of that is this, and not this, then when you go and work with the PNS1 system, and you compute the radiation from that system, and you compare to black holes, it agrees perfectly. So in fact, we know that this is the right way to understand how to excite a string, and this is not the right way when you want to talk about the phase where you're actually in the black hole phase. So why did we go through this story? It looks a little bit off the track on which we otherwise were, but just to make ourselves familiar with the fact that we have to firstly think of fractional brains. We may not be able to visualize them, but they are there. They are the ones that are the light objects. They are ones that actually give rise to entropy. They are the ones which can actually make use of what two powers of n in the denominator. That's the double fractionation, while the simple PP bar modes, even though they were more intuitive, had only one power of n1, single fractionation, and that's why really this guy wins over. The g is not going to do all that much. If n is large enough, this guy is always going to win over, and that's the lesson to take away from this. Well, what use is this lesson? The purpose of this lesson was actually to drive towards a certain computation, and so let me now try to go to that calculation. So before I go to that, just one more slide of material is what we require to just collect one more technical piece of information, and that's the following. So far we made black holes in 5D, 4 plus 1 non-compact dimensions. Just wanted to pick up a little bit of lore on how 4D black holes work. So they actually work exactly like the black holes in 5D, and everything which was done for 5D black holes was almost immediately repeated for 4D black holes, and it works perfectly well. In fact, Rob Myers, who might be in the audience here, is one of the people who worked out part of the story for these 4D black holes. So you could do it like this. This is one of the duality language in which you could do it. You take your M9,1, your 10-dimensional string theory. Now you keep only 3 plus 1 dimension non-compact. Then you had your T4, you had the S1. But now you take another S1 to be compact. So you only have 4 non-compact directions left. You wrap your D1 brains on S1. You wrap your D5 brains on T4 cross S1. So far it's all the same as before. You send your momentum charge running along the S1. This is also the same as before. But now, in fact, you need a fourth charge. In 4 plus 1 dimensions, we need only 3 charges to make a good black hole. But in 3 plus 1 non-compact dimensions, we need one more charge, and that's called KK monopoles, which you wrap along all these, which need all these 6 directions to wrap on, and that makes it the fourth charge. But after that, the story actually works exactly like before. If you're not very familiar with KK monopoles, you could just think of this as a kind of D6 brain in some duality language. Just use another kind of brain in the story. But then if you work out the entropy now that you have 4 charges, it's very much similar to what you got for 3 charges. It's 2 pi and all the 4 charges in there. as you might remember, for three charges by dualities, we could permute D1, D5, and P among themselves by dualities. The same is true now. If you had these four charges, you can permute them in all possible ways you like by dualities. And that's why, in fact, I just call them N1, N2, N3, N4. There's not even any point in saying which one is which. Also important for us is the fact, if you do the near extremal story, suppose you had only three charges but added some energy, then again you would say the entropy is coming from the N1, N2, N3, N4. And because you had some N4 and N4 bar, not really N4 charge, but just some extra energy, you have to add the piece 2 pi N1, N2, N3, N4 bar. So in fact, you just add these two pieces and you get the near extremal entropy. So it's all making sense. The game of entropy is all very universal. It's always products of all the charges. We had root N1, N2 in the beginning, root N1, N2, N3. Now root N1, N2, N3, N4. If you have both left and right movers, the bars also come in. Just add these and get entropies. And all these entropies agree perfectly well with what you would get from the dual side of looking at the black hole horizon area. So these are numbers we should trust, down to the last factor of 2 pi. And now, in fact, all these ingredients which I have mentioned to you, all these ingredients of entropy, are all that I'm actually going to use. And now I'm going to, all this was sort of rigorous because you can compute them completely well on the CFP side. On the gravity side, you make a black with those charges, you measure the area, you get exact agreement down to the last factor of 2. But what I'm going to say from now on, because you're going to make an estimate of the size of a bound state, is much more crude. This is a very, very rough and crude argument. So you will see no precision in this. And there will be a lot of things about the argument you might find so crude that you don't like it. And that's OK. You can bypass this argument and still keep the rest of what we are saying. Just want to give you a flavor of how one might want to very abstractly think about these things. So here's the real question for which we were developing all this technology. So how big is the D1, D5 momentum extremal bound state? Why are we asking that question? Our real missing key was to understand three charge black holes, D1, D5, P, let's say. We want to understand them. And if we can make all the microstates, we are done. And what do we want to know about them? If the whole D1, D5, P brain system was only Planck size or string size or something small, of course, it will shrink into a black hole. A horizon would develop. This metric would flip to from being, you know, this time coordinate would flip direction, and you'll have a singularity inside. You can't avoid the usual metric of normal general relativity, a Reichenau-Nordström black hole. On the other hand, suppose this D1, D5P microstate, when you put these brains together, itself was quite big and fluffy, then in fact, the guy would be so big that no horizon might form. And then, of course, we'll get these microstates the way our picture has been trying to say. So we want the size of a D1, D5 momentum bound state, and that's what we want to estimate by just putting together all the numbers that we had on the board so far. Okay, so how are we going to do this? Suppose here is my D1, D5P bound state. It's a little mess here. I just drew the squiggle to show you it's a D1, D5P bound state. Just in the calculation flat space weak coupling, if you like. And I want to know how big it is. What does how big mean? It means you should bring some object close to it. If I'm very far from the bound state, I won't feel anything. If I come closer and closer, if I start feeling some effects of that bound state, well then maybe I can say the bound state extends up to there. So what kind of effects might I possibly feel? This green dot is just a test quantum I bring near this complex. I bring it up to some distance r. And I'm going to think of this distance r as being big because I'm going to really try to see if I can get an answer comparable to the black hole radius or something. It's a big distance. I've written some test quantum here. What I'm really hoping for is, can something so bizarre happen that a brain actually can stretch out all the way from here and perhaps touch or envelop this quantum which comes? Very weird picture. You never see something like this actually happen. But suppose something like this did happen, then of course you would say that this object has its influence extending up to a distance r, and you would have to say this object really extends all the way to distance r. If on the other hand, nothing like this happens, this guy sits quietly here, this guy sits quietly here, then of course we are very far away from the effective size of this object. Okay, so here's the question. Do brains perhaps reach out and touch the test quantum? Are there objects like this which can really stretch out this far? Why are we even thinking there might be objects going this far? Well, again, because of all that we saw, brains have a tension like Planck scale or whatever, but then of course because of fractionation, we had seen that their tension can become very light, and they're very light objects in the system. They can really stretch very far. And so that's the whole key. The number of quanta here are N1, N5, NP, big numbers. The bigger they are with fractionation, the lighter these brains would be, and the further out they can go. We want to see if they can reach up to there. What is that scale? It's just fractionation. We want to play the whole story and see what numbers come up. Okay. So let's see how to do that in more detail. So again, here I've drawn the same picture again. Here's your little bound state of brains. Here the test quantum, so distance r. You want to see the guy reach up there. But if you want a brain to actually stretch out and reach up there, even though it may take more energy or less energy, it might be high tension, low tension, we don't know yet. But where are you going to get any energy from? This was an extremal black hole. It has mass equal to charge. It has no extra energy to spare. You can't take some energy out of an extremal bound state at all. There is no extra energy in the system. Doesn't matter how light this brain is, it might seem you just can't make it. But that's not quite right. There's some energy in the system. If you brought this test quantum here within a distance r, that means it's the process localizing this test quantum here gives it an energy delta E of the order of 1 over r. It's not much. If you're thinking of talking about a black hole kind of separation here, this is like 1 over 3 kilometers in there. It's a very, very small energy budget. With that very small energy budget, we are again going to go back and ask, can a brain actually do a stretching across 3 kilometers with an energy budget just 1 over 3 kilometers? Very small energy. Well, let's see what happens. But we are even more particular than that. We want this process of the brain stretching out and grabbing this particle to not just be possible, but also to be probable. If there's just some chance, some odd chance that by a quantum fluctuation you can get this process, well, that's not so exciting to us. If the chance is more than 50% this will happen, then we are really close enough to that object to be able to feel it. How do we technically put that into the game? Suppose the process of this happening, the volume of phase space which says that this process occurs, volume of phase space which creates a pair of brains. If you make a brain, you have to make them in pairs, so I just wrote a pair. The volume of phase space to create the pair of brains, upon the volume of phase space to not create the pair of brains, if this volume is bigger than this volume, then the process is probable and not just possible. It's more likely you'll make the pairs than you won't make the pairs. Well, volume of phase space is really the entropy, so the entropy for this kind of a configuration where the energy makes the pairs should be, the entropy for this should be more than the entropy for not making the pairs. If the entropy for making the pairs is bigger than, is the delta S is at least 1 or more, that means the volume of phase space for making the pairs is at least a factor of E more than the volume of phase space for not making the pairs. So remember, S was just the volume of phase space. So if delta S is 1 in the process, that means the phase space volume is E times for making the pair as opposed to not making the pair. So it's more than 50% likely you'll make the pair. But now you really got the problem down to a mathematical level from just the pictures. We are coming closer to a point where we can start plugging in some formulae or numbers and getting an answer out of it. And so let's see what we are doing. So again, now here we had this object. I was keeping a drawing this guy stretching out as a brain and grabbing this guy and so on, but as I said, the brain must come in pairs. In any case, I don't know how to draw or visualize a brain actually stretching out, touching or grabbing a particle. So I slightly changed the problem while keeping the same length scales in mind. I just put the whole object in a box of size r. And I say I have my energy budget 1 by r. That's what I had written above. I want the process to make delta S equal to 1. That's what I wrote there. And I put the whole thing in a box. And then I ask, can I get brains using only this much energy budget? We stretch out and wrap the sides of this box and create a delta S equal to 1. How much is the r? It's a slight change of question because I couldn't very well visualize how the brains might wrap a test quantum. I just put a box at the same distance and I ask, can the brains wrap around the walls of the box? It's a bit of a jump, but I can't do any better, so I hope you'll accept this for the moment, because anyway, we are making a very crude estimate. So again, let's look at this question. We have a very small energy budget, a very big box, and we want the process of making these brain pairs to be actually probable. That means the entropy should go up by at least 1 unit when this process actually happens. Let's see what the numbers are. So now I'm pretty much done. The computation is now clear. So again, here's the same picture again. The D1, D5P, that's the system sitting here. My energy budget is 1 over R. What will happen to D1, D5P? Well, now we can start putting in all the things that we had learned. If you add some energy to D1, D5P to a three-charge system, what happens? In the black hole phase, when you have large number of quanta, you make pairs of whatever the fourth charge in the system. What's the fourth charge in the system? The D1, D5P was already made with the T4 cross S1 compactification. Now we have one more S1 compactified. It's a T4 cross S1 and another S1. That's the number of compactifications for the 4D black hole. The 4D black hole had 4 charges. There were D1, D5P, and KK monopoles. If you take D1, D5P and add some energy, it'll go into making pairs of KK, anti-KK, but in fact, the important thing, of course, is there'll be fractional pairs. KK monopoles wrap the circle. That all that is, in fact, exactly true. If you have an S1 like that, we have seen that KK monopoles wrap that circle. That's, in fact, exactly how the Fourchild black hole worked. And so now, at this point onwards, no more assumptions. All the assumptions have already gone in. Now it's just mathematics. If I take D1, D5P, I tell you how much energy I add. I know how many KK, KK bars I can make. I ask how much the entropy goes up. The D1, D5P had this much energy. If I add a fourth charge, the energy becomes N1, N5, NP, and the number of NKKs I make, plus because I also made KK bars, N1, N5, NP, and KK bar. I compute this number, I ask for delta S equal to 1, and I ask at what R that will happen. If the R is very big, my energy budget is very small, and also the brains are very heavy, so I won't get much entropy. If R is, of course, very small, I have a lot of energy, and the brains are also very light, so I can make lots of them. There has to be a trade-off point in the middle, and the critical R when delta S becomes 1, we get some formula like this. The only important thing I want to see from this formula at this stage is that it does increase with the number of quanta. And if you want to trace back how it increases with the number of quanta, positive power of the number of quanta, that of course goes back to the fact that the entropy had fractionation, and so in fact, the number of pieces you got depend on the number of quanta you already had. But once you find a bizarre expression, which is a combination of these 7 variables in that formula, you then go back and find something interesting. If you take the D1, D5P black hole, and you make the classical geometry, and you find the radius of the horizon for that classical geometry, and you wrote that thing out in terms of the charges, the coupling, the volumes, alpha prime, everything, actually you get the same expression. Up to factors of order unity, I will put down the 2s and the pi's in there, because you're making crude estimate, you actually get the same expression. So what have we seen here? Just playing with fractional brains and just getting some kind of rough idea of how things fractionate and become lighter, how they go around and wrap, and using nothing more than the ideas of how we have always counted entropy and near extremal entropy and used them in the black hole game all along, by just putting all that into the soup and trying to estimate how far, well, with a given amount of energy, can you actually, how big a box can you make, and brains will be wrapping it and feeling the walls of the box, doing all these crazy things. All the parameters are in the right place, and because there are 7 variables here, it's quite remarkable, they all fall into exactly the right places, and they make you something which has exactly the scale of the D1, D5P black hole. So in fact, this was a calculation which I done first way back in 97, and found it rather amusing. And it sort of triggered the thought that perhaps fractionation does lead to large objects, but of course this is too crude. You can't find anybody who is willing to believe this on its own, and you shouldn't, of course, it is very crude. But in fact, in the context of everything else that we have seen, it could be rather interesting. Because after this, we went back and started looking at trying to make microstates for special systems. 3 charge is already a little complicated, so you go back down to 2 charge, which is a simple system which has entropy. Then there you can count the states, there you can make all the microstates. There, in fact, because you can see them all, you can look at their size, and again, there it works out. The size of microstates satisfy the Bekenstein kind of law. And so here, of course, this was an estimate, but there you actually have the microstate. And now we are at a stage where we go to 3 charges, we can make a few microstates, the few we make, but they all seem to have these nice gaps at the end. So no horizon, no singularity, all that, at least for the few microstates you can make, the story seems to hold. So that's all I was going to say for this estimate. And since I'm almost out of time, I just put my summary slide down here. So again, what is the whole goal of what we've been talking about over these 3 lectures? We're trying to drive at the following conjecture. And I'll just state the conjecture here and just try to review what kind of little evidence we have for it so far. And then time will show where it goes. So the conjecture has been that bound states in a consistent theory of quantum gravity, like string theory, they're not point-like, but they in fact swell up to a size, and the size depends on their degeneracy. So if you take something like a single one-charge system, doesn't matter how many quanta you put, the degeneracy is just 1. There's just 1 state of a string. If it has just 1 charge, there's no entropy to it, and the guy doesn't get very big. It remains size alpha prime, doesn't matter what the winding number of the string is. But the moment you put 2 or more charges, the entropy goes up, and the guy starts swelling up. And how much does this swell up? Well, the rough size given by the fact, if you compare it to Bekenstein type A over 4G quantity, you'd actually get the degeneracy, the microscopic entropy, from the surface area of this ball. If this conjecture were true, then of course you'd use this to say that perhaps you never form a horizon. So why is that so important? But what we had seen right at the start of the first lecture is that if you make a horizon, it's a kind of pathology. Now, normally in gravity, you think that closed time-like curves are pathological. you think that naked singularities are pathological. But horizons have always been okay with everybody. And they've been okay because any singularity which might come is inside the horizon. But in fact, horizons are not so innocent, because once you have a horizon, Hawking comes in the way, and Hawking's argument that you will have Hawking radiation and you will lose information and therefore destroy quantum mechanics is very robust. If there was something simple and wrong with that argument which you could point out in a few lines, by now you would have heard about it. It's a very robust argument. In fact, I would like to argue, as I was saying at that time, that it's actually a theorem. You could make it into a theorem that if all quantum gravity effects are confined to a bounded length scale, be it Planck length or string length, but something fixed, and your vacuum is unique, two very basic assumptions, you will have information loss. Well, with that, it would seem that if you ever make a horizon, the theory is in trouble. Perhaps a constant theory of quantum gravity always knows that that's a problem and always fixes things so that states always swell up to such a size that there never is a horizon. So, of course, that would resolve the Hawking paradox and also tell us something interesting about the nature of quantum gravity, because then what we would have learned is that the non-local length scale over which quantum gravity messes everything up is not Planck length, but in fact a number that grows with a length which grows with the number of quanta. It's n to the alpha Planck length, like we said in the first lecture, and alpha is always such to give you a horizon-sized ball. Well, there might be a simple reason why all this is happening. If this were to be actually be true, it's a rather bizarre and far-out conjecture, you might think. So in fact, we need to be extremely critical in how we examine this. But for that reason, we might also want to get a good physical understanding of why it might be happening. And it may be something no more than very basic physics. It may just be a question of phase space. If you have an object which has a high amount of entropy, suppose an object has a high degeneracy, there are many ground states in there, you know that an entropy is just the log of the volume of phase space. If I actually try to squeeze all the stuff into a point, at least I've given you no volume of physical space. And that probably means I've given you no phase space either to play in, because in most systems, the x extent and the p size are comparable. A virial theorem normally tells you the p size and the x size are comparable. If I give you no x space to play in, perhaps you'll have no phase space in which you can put all those different states. So if I told you something has a million microstates, you need at least a million times h bar cube units of phase space to make those states in. If I then say that all the states should go to a point, well, they just can't do that. So you can see that happen very explicitly when you look at the case of the NS1P system. And as we said, all two-charge states are dual to all two-charge states. So this lesson applies equally well to D1, D5. But it's very clear in NS1P, because there you just have a string carrying vibrations. And the vibrations had to make you go left and right of the central axis. But suppose I confined you to a narrow tube and said, don't go left and right, stay very close to r equal to 0. I'll give you no space to move. Well, then there are hardly any states of the string. Only some very high frequency, low amplitude states are all the ones you'll be able to count. I just wrote their few states. If you give yourself a little bit more room, then in fact you can put the generic state in there and you will get pretty much all the states. So in fact, if you give me no phase space, I can't make the states. And so if you have degeneracy, you need size. And so the more degeneracy you have, the more size you need. And perhaps that's why states are swelling up and you're always getting a relation like this. So how come we didn't understand this well enough in about black holes when we were doing just playing with ordinary quantum gravity and not string theory? Well, at that time, we never actually made the microstates. We always said black hole has this much entropy. Everybody believed Bekenstein, and that was fine. But we never tried to actually make the state. If we had tried to make e to the s states, just see what a big number it is. It's 10^77 for a solar mass-sized black hole. All that to fit within a 3 kilometer size. Now, that much, if you use the whole volume, perhaps you can make so many states, but people never tried to make the states. String theory is a complete consistent theory, so now you have to see where the states are. Once you start making them, to make that many states orthogonal to each other in the Hilbert space, it seems that you need size, and that's why perhaps the states are swelling up. So I'll just stop here, but if you have questions about this or any abstract issue, then maybe we should talk about it now. Thank you.